our friends with Fantasy Benefits.
Mike, how hard are you right now?
Oh, man, I've been hard since you said, hi, welcome to Friends with Fantasy Benefits podcast.
Good, I feel like we should rename this to Technical Difficulties Podcast.
Yeah.
The loading.
We are friends with Fantasy Benefits.
I got family in the area up there. I'm always up there for Thanksgiving. We should, you should drive me to a bar.
No, I can do that. I've been people's taxis more than once.
We are friends with Fantasy Benefits.
What the heck is going on in that Mets outfield? I cannot figure it out. I love Michael Conforto, man.
Everybody does, except for the Mets.
Yeah, I know. I think I would just...
We are friends with Fantasy Benefits.
Welcome to the Friends of Fantasy Benefits Baseball Podcast. I'm Justin Mason, lead fantasy writer and analyst for friendsoffantasybenefits.com. Joined with me on this episode is Eli Rosenzweig. Eli, how you doing?
I'm good. I feel like we should rename this to Technical Difficulties Podcast.
Yeah.
The loading.
And that voice is our special guest. That is Eno Saris of Fangraphs. We have been struggling for the last 25 minutes trying to figure out how to use Skype properly for this call, which hasn't been a problem for the first 255 episodes of this podcast. But Eno, how you doing?
Oh, well, I brought it with me, I guess. I've been having trouble with my own podcast, and we finally just solved it by leaving Skype behind. So.
Oh, well, I'll have to ask you what you guys are using after the podcast, because this is pissing me off, though I am going to be moving to a Mac here shortly, so I hear they have better options. So, Eno, why don't you tell people a little bit about yourself, although I'm sure everybody on this podcast know who you are, because we reference your work all the time, but give yourself some plugs and then tell people where they can reach you on social media.
Yeah, I used to be the fantasy editor over at Fangraphs, where I hired you before I left Rotographs behind a little bit. I don't know. I still post there from time to time. And I think my posts on the front of the site at Fangraphs are very sort of fantasy informed. I'm often basically asking a player, what did you do to change your performance? And in my head, I'm asking them, will it stick? I don't usually say that out loud, so for various reasons. And then, I'm also now the managing editor over at a site called October. That's OCT.co, which is a craft beer site. It's not craft beer. It's actually all beer. And we're kind of trying to be beer plus, like where we're doing events. We did a Run the Jewels show in Charlotte, and we're doing dinners, and we have pieces about, you know, beer in different contexts and in different cultural contexts. So it's not actually as geeky and nerdy as Beer Graphs, my last beer venture. That's sort of what I do. You can find me on Twitter at Enosarris and also on Facebook at a similar or the same. And you'll see sandwiches on my Instagram page and a little bit of beer and baseball on Twitter, or a lot of beer and baseball on Twitter.
Yes, definitely.
I gotta say, you know, I'm a big fan of the Beergrass site. Anytime I travel anywhere in the United States, I always go on Beergrass to see what options I can find that I haven't tried before. I still haven't gotten to the Heady Topper yet. That's my number one goal in life.
Yeah, it's a good beer. My personal favorites actually are probably not in that top five, although Pliny the Elder is, to me, like the OG of craft beer. It's definitely, but I like a lot of the things that they're doing now that are kind of newer, but that's cool. I mean, that's definitely a beer that you have to taste once. And it, in fact, inspired a lot of what's happening now, Heady Topper did. So, yeah, that was actually the point of Beer Graphs to me, was to have leaderboards like Fan Graphs that you could sort when you were in a new town. You could say, hey, I'm in Phoenix for work. Let me see the best beers that Arizona has to offer so that I can, you know what I'm looking for when I go to the bar or whatever. So, we also help people who are trading. You know, people like to trade beers so they can see, okay, well, I've got these beers and those beers look attractive in your locale. So, it's kind of just and then we also did research, and we're going to do some of that in October, but try to make it really accessible.
And I am, you know, obviously, I've mentioned before, I'm a recovering alcoholic, so I don't drink beer. However, I do live really, really, like, 2 miles away from where they brew Pliny the Elder. So, I mean, I can always go and pick some up for someone for a nominal fee.
That's a great place right there.
Send some to Boston, buddy.
Yeah, I got family in the area up there. I'm always up there for Thanksgiving. We should you should drive me to a bar.
No, I can do that. I've been people's taxis more than once in my life. All right, let's start talking about some fantasy baseball because we've wasted a lot of time messing around with Skype and the recording software. So. And we don't want to have to keep you for too long, you know, but let's just jump in. The opening question I wanted to kind of start with was, what are you looking for from players kind of this early in the season in terms of, you know, small sample sizes? What stats are you actually paying attention to, or is it mostly just watching games and seeing how guys are adjusting?
You know, there are some stats that become meaningful quicker, and I think that the easiest way to think about it is think about the denominator of the stat you're looking at. So if you're looking at a stat that has something to do with balls in play, like home runs or doubles or batting average, all of those, the denominator is balls in play. So if you go to the plate, you know, in today's game, if you go to the plate four times, you might put one ball in play. So if you look at something that the denominator is pitches, then all of a sudden you're talking about in those four, you might see 12 to 16 pitches. So instead of four pieces of data per game, you're getting 16. So I prefer to look at things that are per pitch right now, and that's true for pitchers and hitters. So for pitchers, that means velocity. You know, I try to look at movement too, but movement's a little screwed up right now as they're doing some calibration of the systems. They just switched over to TrackMan. But, you know, I still try to look at changes in movement, changes in velocity. And for hitters and for pitchers, I think the first thing that becomes meaningful is contact rate. And that's can be really useful to see a pitcher like Jeremy Hellickson, who's struggling right now, and he's struggling to get whiffs. And that's going to be relevant to his performance going forward. So I wouldn't necessarily say that like Jeremy Hellickson is done for the season, but I'm more worried about him than I was going into the season. You know, so I it does inform my opinion of him. And, you know, that's and then on top of that, if you are going to look at balls in play, it's better to look at something like exit velocity than it is to look at results because, you know, right now, if they had, you know, four balls that should have been doubles and two of them got tracked down by, you know, Billy Hamilton, then they look like they don't have much power. But if you look at the exit velocity, you can say, oh, wow, you know, he did hit those four balls hard. So, you know, it's all about
kind of like what happened to Jarrell Cotton in his first start.
Yeah, exactly. And that it's funny, too, because it's funny you bring up Cotton because I didn't actually a reader actually brought that to my attention. What happened was I was watching the game. So watching the game, like you said, is very important, especially early on. So I was watching the game and I was like, nobody can hit his changeup. The cutter looks fine. The fastball is not like a booming, you know, 96, 97, but it's not even Hendricks level. You know, it's not a liability in terms of velocity. It's 92, 93, 94. You know, I saw some 94s. So, you know, I saw everything I needed to see. And then I saw them take a couple curveballs, which are his worst pitch. And, you know, in this one inning, Simmons took a curveball that was a foot and a half off the plate and just dinked it into center field. I mean, it just looked barely made contact. So I thought, A, his curveball's not his best pitch. Maybe he'll throw less of them. And that's what he did in the second one. Or throw fewer of them. And then B, that's not a very strong hit. I mean, I don't know how many people can expect that to keep happening. So, and then somebody, I was saying something about it on Twitter, and somebody said the average exit velocity of the four RBI hits that were off of him was like 75 miles per hour. 95 miles per hour is like when Cespedes came over to the Mets, he averaged 95 miles an hour for that half a season when everything was a hit. You know, 95 miles an hour, 90 plus is when you start getting hits. 75 is not usually a hit. So, you know, lo and behold, Cotton, I told people to keep Cotton going out, and I would say pretty much dominated the Royals.
Yeah.
I mean, the Royals may not be the best offense, but
he
was really good. I mean, nobody could hit that changeup, and that's a good place to start.
I know this isn't on the show notes, but since we're talking about Jarrell Cotton, I got a question for you. Are you worried about like the motion on his arm at all when he throws that pitch? Yeah. I mean, I watched this like close-up GIF of it, and it just looks like his arm is going to fall off.
Yeah, I am worried about it. I did a story where I tried to invent a new pitch, and I basically found that the type of movement we're missing right now is basically screwball movement. And I was on a panel with Dallas Braden, and Dallas actually mimicked his screwball release for me. And I did. I took a video of it, and you can hear me on the video going, "Ow!" And then I was sitting next to him at this panel, and he said that Dr. James Andrews looked at his shoulder and said, "You got to stop throwing that pitch, man." And when they were doing surgery, and then also, if you're sitting next to Dallas Braden, one of his hands is his left hand that he pitched with is sort of internally rotated. Like it's not like if he puts his hand down on the table, one of them is like pointed in.
Oh
like
my gosh.
Like pointed down. So, I don't think it's going to be great for him long term. You know, I think the A's don't care because they expect to keep pitchers like 3 years anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I think for fantasy owners, it's a guy you want now, and I mean, we don't know that much about injury, but I think you may want to sell on him, you know, in the next 3 to 4 years. Even Braden had a couple good years, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just wonder because, I mean, yeah, I was watching that GIF over and over and over again. I'm like, and I just couldn't understand how his arm stays intact doing it. So I figured since we were on that topic, might as well ask. Eli, any thoughts on the opening question? Is anything in particular you're looking for early on in the season?
I'm kind of with Eric Caraballo on this kind of topic. I'm not really reacting to anything at this point. I don't think I'm going to make many roster moves at all for the first month. I'll just ride out any slumps. I think it's a lot easier to evaluate pitchers, though. Kind of like Elo said, you can look at the velocity, pitch mix, if they have any new pitches that they added to their repertoire. So I think it's easy to make some judgments on pitchers early on. But for hitters, you know, there's really not much to go on. You know, I do like to look at if they're drawing more walks, striking out more, pitches per plate appearances, if they try to kind of change their approach at all. Like, you know, Tim Anderson was a guy I was hoping would maybe make some adjustments, maybe take some more pitches, but nothing seems to have changed with him. So Tim Anderson's a guy I've been disappointed with early on, but I can't say that I'm that surprised.
Yeah, the only other thing I'll add is I like to look and see where guys are batting in the lineup. I mean, we saw Byron Buxton, for instance, starting off the season batting third, and he's already at this point dropped to ninth in the order. So just kind of keeping an eye on, especially younger guys, where the teams are hitting them on a regular basis. And then platoons and how platoons are working out in terms of guys getting at bats. And FanGraphs on the front page has the team pages now, which is a really nice tool to kind of gauge a lot of those platoon splits and things like that. Let's jump into the players we're going to discuss initially. You know, and just like every podcast, I put these notes together a couple days in advance, and of course the players I put on there have to screw up my notes. But Trevor Story was starting out the year really, really, really cold, and of course last night hit his first home run off of Madison Bumgarner. So maybe this is a moot question, you know, but are you worried at all about Trevor Story?
I'm always a little bit worried about Trevor Story because, you know, I personally prefer guys who make contact. I mean, you know, when there's an opportunity, every player has his price, right? So, you know, in some cases, like I bought Miguel Sano for my American AL labor squad, which is a, you know, 12-team AL only industry team, and I bought him because I thought he was cheap and has 40 home run power. I didn't expect him to necessarily improve his contact rate. With Story, I felt the same way. Like, he's going to hit the ball hard, and he's going to have a bad batting average, and some of that's going to be mitigated by Coors. I don't see too much a difference, and the one thing that probably takes the longest to be believable is power. I mean, we can look at exit velocity, in which case he's still in the top third. But again, how many balls has he put in play? I see on his FanGraphs page, he's put 24 balls in play. So I think that's not really a fair number to judge them on. And things like isolated slugging percentage, which I like to use because it takes batting average out, and some of that, those singles, those BABIP singles, even isolated slugging percentage takes like 400 at-bats to become stable, as you might say, in statistical terms. So I'm not too worried about him. One thing that I liked when I looked under the hood last year was that he had a couple different streaks, and that said to me that he made a couple different adjustments. He's not a guy who, you know, the whole league has figured out. He came, and he was on fire, and then he did slow down, but he also had other moments of fire. You know? Mm-hmm. So I think maybe the wheels churn a little bit slower, or maybe he doesn't have great pitch recognition skills. But I think after a little bit, he starts to understand, okay, now they're all throwing 60% breaking balls to me, so I have to have sort of a breaking ball approach, and then he'll hit some home runs, and then they'll go back to the fastballs, you know? So I think that there's enough there that I'm not selling Story right now.
Eli, any worry about Trevor Story?
Not really. He played a lot of his early games this season on the road, and so I'm not surprised that his start has been pretty slow. He hit 78 points lower on the road, got on base at 101 points lower on the road, and slugged 239 points lower on the road. So obviously, massive platoon split for Story for home road. So the slow start is not that surprising. And you know, anytime you got a guy that strikes out over 30% of the time, he's going to have several mini slumps throughout the season. His just happens to be at the beginning of the year, and you know, you always tend to notice that. You're not going to notice any stretch like this in the middle of the year. So I'm not too worried about Story.
Yeah, I'm not worried either, and I think this comes to a lot of your earlier point, Eli, is I tend not to freak out early on unless I see something really bad, an injury, guys getting moved completely out of, you know, the top of the order. I'm not worried about Story. They really need him to be viable this season in Colorado in that division. He's not swinging more outside the zone than he did last. He's actually swinging less outside the zone, so I think he's going to be fine, and I think last night maybe is the beginning of the turnaround. And once he starts playing more games at Coors, you're going to see the Coors effect help him out quite a bit. So he may not post as strong of an average as he did last year. I think the 270 average he posted last year was a little bit fluky, but he's going to offer power. He's going to, you know, he's not going to put up an average that's going to kill you. So I'm still fine with Trevor Story. Let's talk about Matt Harvey, and it's interesting because when I put him on this note, he hadn't got hurt, but it appears his hamstring is going to be fine. You know, you're a Mets fan. What have you seen from Harvey in his first two starts? Are you encouraged?
I don't think we're going to see the old dominant Matt Harvey. I know that the superficial results look a little bit familiar in terms of he has a, you know, ERA below 7. But if you look at the strikeouts, the contact rate, and then most importantly, I think the velocity, I think you notice that something's a little bit off. You know, our velocity readings right now, since they're switching over to TrackMan, are basically hot everywhere. Mm-hmm. So you kind of, if you're looking at this year's numbers, you kind of want to subtract a half tick. So if you look at the fact that he has, you know, a 94-mile-an-hour fastball right now, it looks like he has the same as he did last year. Well, first of all, last year he was injured. And second of all, you kind of have to reduce that to this year's number. So he hasn't got all the velocity back. If you want to look at, think of him in past year's terms, he almost has a 93-mile-an-hour fastball right now. When he was at his best, he was averaging 95.9, 95.8. And if you look at fastballs, like in particular fastballs over 96, are really effective, and there's sort of a moment there where I think fastballs over 96 are rare, especially from a starter, and then when you start talking about 93 and 94 mile an hour fastballs, that's much more common. So I think we're going to see much more pedestrian results going forward. The one nice thing is he couldn't feel his fingertips last year, and he's filling up the zone right now, so maybe he won't. He maybe will have like a return to that 1.5, 1.8 walks per nine, where he's not really walking many people. But I think that will come with a rise in home runs because he's throwing to the middle of the zone more often, and he's throwing 93 instead of 96. So I expect to see something that looks a lot actually like what the projections say, sort of a 3.7 ERA with a 1.2 WHIP. 7 to 8 strikeouts per nine, it's useful. And if you're selling and somebody's trying to treat him like he's not useful at all, that's not great. But also a 3.75 ERA is not what some people might think he is right now. So I'd actually be shopping him. I don't know what you can get. You probably didn't pay ace prices. So I think shopping him along with the batter for a better batter to someone who has a hurt ace or one of their aces was Garrett Cole or something, you know, shop Harvey to them and see if you can improve one of your batters.
Eli, what are your thoughts on Matt Harvey?
Yeah, I love that idea of shopping Harvey right now. I mean, he's stranded 100% of his base runners. I don't think that will sustain. His BABIP against is 161. And like Eno said, even though the velocity looks like it's, you know, what it used to be, it really isn't. So, and also, he's throwing, seems like he's throwing a lot more sliders than usual. That also worries me a little bit for his health. So, you know, people might think that now that he's healthy, he could return to the, you know, borderline top 10 kind of guy that he was before. But I think he's more along the lines of like a top 25 kind of guy. So since he's pitching well, maybe now's the time to move him before it's too late.
Yeah, I'm always willing to kind of just try to get a return on my investment. And I was in on Harvey because of the draft price this year. I was willing to take the gamble, especially kind of late in draft season when the price really plummeted before he started having good results right at the end of spring. So if you can get a good price, if someone really believes this is the reemergence of Matt Harvey, then yeah, go right ahead, try to shop him around and see what you can get. But I also don't think you necessarily have to worry about the floor falling out, which is what a lot of people thought was going to happen, that he was going to get injured again, that he was going to struggle very much like last year. So I think he's got a safer floor than some people do.
But it's a fine line, actually. I think you're right that he doesn't look as injured as I thought he would. I mean, just the fact that he can get the ball in the zone means that some of the command has returned. So I feel like he's you know, some feeling has returned to his fingers, basically.
Mm-hmm. Which is fairly important.
Yeah, it's a big deal when you're pitching. If you can't feel your fingers, it's going to be a hard time getting a good grip on things. So I'm encouraged, but I do agree that the velocity, though, I mean, you know, hopefully the velocity will continue to build throughout the season, but I don't think he has the top five upside that maybe or top five, top ten pitcher upside that we thought.
No, it's fine. The one thing is that the surgery he had, there's not a big sample size on it, so we don't actually know recoveries that well from thoracic outlet. I mean, yes, there was Chris Carpenter who did pretty well after it, but it also ended the careers of two or three other pitchers. So I would normally say that velocity you'd only expect another half tick or so between now and August, maybe a full one, and that's not really enough for him. But at the same time, like I said, there's not a lot of thoracic outlet guys out there.
Rich Hill wishes he couldn't feel his fingers. That way he wouldn't have to go in the DL every 5 minutes with a blister.
I would be much more aggressive in selling him if I have him in a dynasty or keeper league.
Yes, like,
The long-term health is what scares me for the most part. Let's go ahead and talk about Jay Bruce, who's been tearing the cover off the ball. Eli, what are your thoughts on Jay Bruce? Is he returned to Bruce Almighty?
I mean, he's pretty much what he's always been. Like, he's just a guy that is pretty damn consistent. 25 homers, 75 runs, 85 RBIs. Like, his batting average may fluctuate wildly from year to year, but, you know, I'll take the consistency in the other three categories. And he's in a good lineup, a pretty good park for power. You know, he's been around forever, so people think he's, like, getting old, but he just turned 30. So I think this could be a really solid year for Bruce.
You know, what are your thoughts on Jay Bruce?
The second type of stat that becomes meaningful is the kind that's a little bit more agnostic about, that's the exit velocity launch angle. It's a little bit more agnostic about what the actual play ended up being. The kind of thing that describes the ball in play as opposed to saying that was a double or a home run, right? So ground ball for fly ball and otherwise known as launch angle and exit velocity, those things become meaningful a little bit quicker, as quick as 50 balls in play, because you're just describing what the ball looked like. You're not describing what happened, you know? You're not describing that, you know, this outfielder fell down and it turned into a triple, you know? So, you know, I do kind of sneak a glance at ground ball per fly ball numbers earlier in the season. And, Bruce is hitting more fly balls than he's ever hit. I might not spend too much time looking at that, except he made a point out of telling reporters in the offseason that he wanted to put the ball in the air more. So, you know, I put those two things together and I say, okay, here's a guy who's trying to, you know, elevate, who's trying to punish the ball in the air. He's gonna probably strike out more. We have a long history of him striking out more. So that batting average is going to go down. And so he probably is going to end up like regular Bruce, like you said. However, I think it's probably going to be like the 34 to, you know, if he has a 34 homer season on his under his belt. If he's healthy all year, I could see him hitting 36, 37, 38 this year with this new sort of fly ball driven approach. You know, even if it's 250, you know, 38 homers is a big deal. Yeah, I think he's going to be useful all year. The one caveat for me is, what the heck is going on in that Mets outfield? I cannot figure it out. I love Michael Conforto, man.
Just, everybody does, except for the Mets.
Yeah, I know. I think I would just... I mean, they're putting Lonnie Chisenhall in center in Cleveland.
Oh,
I would put...
Oh, my gosh.
I know. Bring back
Grady Sizemore.
I'm a huge Bradley Zimmer guy, and like, he's my AL Rookie of the Year pick. And
God.
I mean, like, I'm just sitting there going, Bradley Please. Zimmer. He even if he strikes out too much, even if he, you know, doesn't hit for power right away, he at least has the speed and the premium defense in center field. The idea that they're putting Chisenhall in center just makes me want to rip whatever hair I have left out.
And the best thing about Zimmer is he's left-handed, and you have Austin Jackson. It's such a natural pairing where both of them play plus defense. You bat them both eighth or ninth in your lineup, and you say, hey, you know, don't worry about it, man. Just do whatever you want on offense. We have you out there to catch balls. And then you might get a bonus of Zimmer figuring it out. So I don't know. I would do that. I think there's also a natural platoon in right field with Chisenhall and Guyer.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit less natural to figure out the Mets outfield. But Conforto lost, you know, 15, 20 pounds, I think, over the offseason. He looks slimmer. He's a good, like, he's a really good baseball player. Like, that's definitely the thing I get from watching him, is that he knows when to push and pull. He knows what pitchers are trying to do with him. And I think that would translate to getting the most out of his athleticism in center field. I wouldn't want to play him in center field for 3, 4, 5 years, but next year, Lucas Duda is probably gone. And then you don't really have this backlog where you can just move, you know, you can move guys around and somebody can play first base. But for
Bruce is gone too, right?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So it'll figure itself out that way. But, you know, for 1 year, I'd play Conforto in center field. They need to score some runs.
Can we talk about an outfield situation even crazier than the Mets? How about the White Sox? They're starting Garcia in left field today, Garcia in center field today, and Garcia in right field today. Abascal in right.
Lewis?
Yeah, Larry in center, Lewis? And Willie Garcia, who just got called up and left, replacing Melky, who's on paternity leave.
Oh, this is good. I love it when I don't know who a person is, because I need to know, like, 400 to 500. I need to know, like, the top 10 to 20 prospects for each team. I do not know who Willie Garcia is.
Yeah, I'm a White Sox fan, and I barely know who Willie Garcia is.
I did all 30 team prospect previews for this podcast, and I don't know who he is.
Yeah. You know the White Sox? When's the last time they had a good outfielder? Like, friggin', like, Jermaine Dying, Carlos Lee, Maglio. It's been a while.
They have a hard time developing players. I mean, like, you pointed out with Tim Anderson, they don't develop good plate discipline. You know, you'd hope that they developed good power or contact skills alongside that, but it hasn't really worked out. I guess Tim Anderson has a little bit more power than people expected. And the only reason I'm not as out maybe as on you on Tim Anderson is deep leagues. I feel like his defense will keep, and the how crappy the team is,
mm-hmm.
will keep Tim Anderson in the lineup.
Yeah, I've been disappointed, not just with the plate discipline, that's expected, but he's not even running. He had a small amount of steals last year in 99 games. I forget what it was. It was like 12 or not even. And he's got one so far this year. It's just disappointing.
Yeah.
Eli's also a very, very bitter White Sox fan, so.
Now, well, their 10-year free pass is over. I gave them a 10-year window after that World Series. I didn't care. But now I'm starting to get annoyed. But at least they're going in the right direction.
Hey, this
that was a crazy World Series win, though. I mean, I think that was out of left field.
Amazing. Kind
of.
Let's move on. Talk about Tyler Glass now, who really, really struggled in his first start of the season. And I think there were reports today that I saw that they are going to unveil a new delivery for the next game.
He was supposed to do that in the spring. That's amazing.
Yeah. So, Ray Searidge said he will display a new pitch delivery in Saturday's start. I'm very, very concerned, and I have a lot of shares because I've been a big Glasnow guy for a long time. Eno, I know you were higher than most on Glasnow coming into the season. Are you concerned?
Well, a lot of times he was in that part of the part of my rankings where I focus on upside in the sort of 70s to 80s. I think if you're picking a guy there, you're picking your last pitcher for most mixed leagues. And, picking your last pitcher, what do you want? You want a guy who's going to tell you pretty quickly if you want to keep him or not, because that's kind of a churn and burn spot. And so I wanted to have a guy that has a lot of upside that maybe after two starts, I could say, this isn't working out. And I'd like to say, I'm not sure this is working out. that delivery would change. Was supposed to happen in the spring. That's why I thought he had the upside to kind of put together the strikeouts plus a better command. Maybe he'll come out and dominate this time and we'll see some better command. But usually, command comes from repeatability and confidence. And I think changing your delivery in the regular season doesn't speak well to confidence. And I don't think it speaks that well to repeatability either.
Obviously, Ray Searidge is trash. This is a terrible pitching coach. Team Don Cooper, baby.
Eli, any thoughts on Tyler Glass now?
Yeah, I mean, he's obviously really talented. I mean, he plays for a pretty good team, pitches in the NL, he's got filthy stuff. So he's certainly a guy that there's reasons to like. He's probably going to be an elite strikeout guy at some point. But there just seems to be too many problems right now for that to come to fruition this year. I mean, His controls are going to prevent him from being consistent. He walked 81 guys last year at 140 innings, and that was in AAA. So if you can't find your control in AAA, good luck finding it in your first major league season at age 23. And also, like, if you're in a quality start league, is he going to be able to go deep enough in the games to get you six innings? Probably not. Maybe he's a guy that figures it out in the second half, but at that point, he might be on the verge of getting shut down on an innings limit. I can't imagine they'd let him get past 160 by much. So I'm not long-term, maybe, but this year, no.
I think I'm holding for right now. I think even though he really struggled in that first start, it was only an inning and two thirds. And I think it's some sort of vote of confidence by the organization that they're not just sending him right back down. They're going to make these tweaks with Ray Searidge at the major league level, at least for the time being. So if they've got some confidence in him, maybe they're seeing something outside of the games that is encouraging to them. I'm not starting him. I'm just keeping him on my reserve right now. But I'm going to hold on if I've taken him in anywhere. 10, 12 team leagues, I'm sure you could probably, ditch him for whoever's hot or whoever's got two starts. But in terms of, NL only, 15 team mix or larger, I'm holding for right now. I'm not bailing this early. Let's talk about Ryan Schimpf, because Ryan Schimpf is an interesting guy. Was starting out the year really Ryan Schimpf-like with a really awful batting average and some power. Eli, what are your thoughts on Ryan Schimpf?
Seemingly nobody believes in this guy. Maybe it's because his last name is Schimpf, or maybe because he came out of nowhere, or because he didn't make the majors until he was 28, or because no one thinks the Padres are allowed to have relevant fantasy options. Or maybe because he's hitting in a ballpark that's not very easy to hit for power. Or maybe because he strikes out too much. Or maybe because he's not going to hit better than 240. There's no but coming. I don't believe in Ryan Schimpf. He's probably better than people think. But I think the hot start is mostly a mirage. I mean, obviously he's useful in NL-only leagues. But I don't think there's going to be any type of breakout here. Like he's probably better than people give him credit for. But whatever.
Any interest in Ryan Schimpf?
I have a name. Aaron Hill.
Hmm.
Totally Aaron Hill. And the thing that Aaron Hill did that was so weird in Toronto was he hit every ball in the air. And that's Shimp's claim to fame. What's funny is that he doesn't actually do it very hard. Like his exit velocity is in the bottom 5%. But he hits the ball in the air, and he's very good at it. And in fact, nobody has played a full season and had the same ground ball per fly ball rate that he has, and he's doing it again this year. I expected to regress some and not be able. No one's hit like 65% fly balls for like a full season. Basically, Rod Barajas did it twice for catcher seasons. So those aren't full seasons. I'm really fascinated. I love like watching him statistically. I don't love watching him at the plate so much, and I don't think I really want to own him that much. I guess the caveat is in on base percentage leagues, he's a lot more useful. And, in deep leagues, I do think he'll find his way to 25, 30 homers again. It may not be a lot of fun to watch on the way.
Yeah, I just wonder if at some point the Padres, who are obviously in a tank season, maybe
tank decade.
puts a younger, maybe tries out some younger guys at the position. I've not been a Ryan Shimp guy. I was actually hoping that Spangenberg would make the roster because I was having a little bit of hope for him to maybe get some sneaky steals. Though he didn't make the opening day roster. He should be up at some point though. I've not been a Ryan Shimp fan. The 60% fly ball rate, 64.9% fly ball rate last year. That is absolutely insane. But like you said, he's doubling down on it this year at 62.5%. So I mean, he's putting as much as he can in the air and just hoping it gets out. At some point, pitchers are going to do their best to exploit that, and I just don't believe. I don't think he gets to 20 home runs this year.
That's interesting. I don't think a lot of the talent that's in the Padres system is like 17 years old. So
yeah, that's true.
That's Fernando Tatis Jr., White Sox legend.
So they're I think waiting for those guys to grow up a little bit. So I'm not. Spangenberg is interesting. I think he will be the guy that takes the job if someone takes the job. But they also I think would rather Shimp did what he did last year again and they could sell him.
Yeah.
So
yeah, he's not part of their like future good team because like I said, he's already 28. So yeah, they should try to sell him.
So I think they'll give him a decent amount of run, and if he's traded somewhere, lefty hitting guy who can play second and third, going to be useful for some team out there due to injury or just giving up on what they have internally. I do think that he's most likely to be traded into playing time again. So there is definitely a collapse concern. That's why I brought up Aaron Hill because. Aaron Hill
had those seasons where he just kind of disappeared.
Hit like 110. And he was the same guy where he had like a 50 plus. I think there's something like mechanically almost not feasible about having, a fly ball rate over 55%. Those were years where he hit 36. He had 36 homers with a .286 average in 2009. Cannot believe that. Aaron Hill. And then in 2010, he had 26 homers with a .205 average. And he had one more good season with Diamondbacks. And then, that was it.
I always wanted him to pan out. All right, let's move on. Let's talk about some waiver wire guys, some guys who've started off fairly well and are available in the majority of leagues. Let's start off with Patrick Corbin, who at one point was everybody's sweetheart. Are you believing in a resurgence from Patrick Corbin,
No. he never had a changeup. And, I think that a right-hander can get away with not having a changeup because they see there's more right-handers in the league. But a left-hander without a changeup is just... he tries to throw it. It's just not a good one. And, I just don't think that, cause you're going to see lineups full of right-handers and you're going to try and throw that slider and you're going to hang a couple of sliders and they're going to go right into those wheelhouses and you're going to give up home runs. So I think you'd have to, there's not many guys. Even I actually talked to the big unit recently. I talked to Randy Johnson and I forgot that he threw a changeup. I thought he was fastball slider. So I was asking him, did you manipulate that slider? Did you kind of have a secret curveball that you used? And he's like, no, I had a split finger fastball. And I was like, duh, of course you did. I was a kid. Mm-hmm,
yeah. We all were.
But, I mean, look at his, he's not getting whiffs really. And he's not, I wouldn't say there's a fundamental change to his changeup that makes me think that I believe in him now.
Eli, you believe in Patrick Corbin?
No, I feel better. Usually I'm the one who just shits on every single player and like a negative about everyone, but I feel better about myself because both of you guys are ragging on all these dudes too. Corbin's been unhealthy or unproductive for four of the last 5 years. And when he was good in 2013, he wasn't as good as maybe we remember he was. He was 35th in the majors in ERA, 29th in whip, and 30th in strikeouts. You know, obviously solid, and, you know, you'd like to have that on your team, but not exactly a stud. I'm sure he can help you this year a little bit, but temper your expectations, because, again, when he was good, he wasn't elite anyway.
Yeah. I think we all just remember that that really hot start that he had. Because didn't he start that 2013 season? Now I got to go look it up. He started like that 2013 season, like 8-0.
Yeah, that does sound familiar.
And then he got hurt. And yeah, that's what it was. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. He started that season out 9-0. And then he was hurt for a little bit. And people really thought that this was a breakout from Patrick Corbin. I was never a believer. And so I'm still not. I mean, he's still walking a bunch of guys. Like Eno said, I don't believe that he's got a full enough arsenal to survive in Arizona of all places. So I'm not in on Patrick Corbin. I think if you've gotten him and can sell him, now's the time.
It's the same problem that Robbie Ray has, except that Robbie Ray throws wicked hard.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So if you're wondering why Robbie Ray has crazy walk rates or gives up too many home runs, it's that his choice against some righties is to walk them or give up a home run and go in the zone and give up a home run because he doesn't believe in his changeup. So
there's a huge difference between 92 and 90, 95 to 97.
And then a nice thing also about Robbie Ray is that this year he's really thrown a curveball.
Mm-hmm.
So I see more to believe in with Robbie Ray than I do with Corbin.
Let's move on to another guy. We'll talk about Wilmer Defoe, who is handling the shortstop duties in Washington with Stephen Drew and Trey Turner on the DL. Eli, is this a good time to pick up Wilmer Defoe?
Yeah, for like a week, but that's it. I mean, Turner's probably going to come back for the DL on April 19th, which will put Defoe right back to the bench. Now, I loved him as a fantasy prospect back in the day because he had a 14 homer, 49 steal season in 2014, but he's never had more than 7 homers in any other year. And that monster season came in A-ball when he was older than most of his competition. So it's kind of, deceiving anyway. I mean, he might be a good play in DFS for the next 5 days or so if he's leading off. And I might stream him in certain leagues to pick up a couple steals. But once Turner's back, that's pretty much it for Defoe. And, this is a guy that could be a super utility player at some point in his career maybe. But I just don't think it's going to happen with this team. Because, they got Turner and Murphy up the middle. And then they got elite outfielders. So this is really no spot for Defoe to get any significant time.
Eno, are you interested in Defoe?
Very little power. Not as much contact as you'd expect from a little guy like him. So basically what I'm saying is bad batting average, no power. And I don't think it's elite speed, but he did have a year, 2014, he stole 49 bases. So it's just not... If you're the young guy coming up like that, I don't think that they turn you loose. You're pitching, you're hitting in front of the pitcher a lot, I guess you could steal a base there, but you have to get on base first. I don't know. No.
Justin, why didn't you put any good players on the show sheet?
Well, I'm going to go to bat for Defoe because I think he does have pretty close to elite speed. I mean, it's not Billy Hamilton speed, but he's fast, right. And I think. it looks like, if I'm not mistaken, I believe Stephen Drew is going to be out quite a while, which means he could kind of take over that utility role, even once Trey Turner comes back. And who knows what Trey Turner, you know, hamstrings injuries can be really, really tricky, and they can reoccur if they're, you know, if people don't give him enough time to heal. I know he's coming back quickly, and that worries me a little bit with Trey Turner. So I think Defoe is a guy who could sneakily get you double-digit stolen bases, you know, over the course of the next couple months. Because even if Turner comes back, I mean, Drew's not going to be back for a while, and Defoe will get, you know, the occasional at-bats to be able to pinch run. So, I mean, obviously we're talking NL only or, you know, deeper mixed, but I think Defoe is a guy that is a sneaky source of speed, you know, not going to do much in the power department, but he walks, you know, decent amount, you know, 7-8% of the time. So I think he is a guy that you guys are poo-pooing a little bit too much.
Well, poo-poo on you.
let's talk about Kendall Graveman, who was throwing a no-hitter until Twitter the kind of jinxed him. Eno, you watch a lot of A's games. What are your thoughts on Kendall Graveman?
I think he made a decision that simultaneously raised his floor and lowered his ceiling. He decided to throw 95% fastballs, and he does have three fastballs, so it's a cut, a sinker, and a four-seam fastball. Same time, to me, that means, okay, that cleans up his command. That makes him good in that way. He was having some trouble with command, giving up too many home runs before. But it also lowers his ceiling because he doesn't have he's literally thrown one breaking ball. One. So I see his ceiling as Bartolo Colon. And I mean American League Bartolo Colon. So I don't, and you know, you, like a younger version, and not even young Bartolo Colon, like a younger version of old Bartolo Colon.
I was about to ask, like, are we talking Indians Bartolo Colon?
No.
Or Angels?
We're basically talking Athletics Bartolo Colon.
Oh, okay.
Oh, so he does. So Kendall Graveman doesn't have a secret family yet. That's coming later.
No, but you know, that said, Bartolo Colon, you know, had, I'm not even, that one year where he had a 2.65 ERA, that seems a little crazy, and that was also 2013, which is a little bit more dead ball, like the, you know, the ball's going out of the park more since. So I'm talking about basically a 4 ERA with a good whip. I don't know, it's very useful in deep leagues, and if you bought him for a dollar in the American League only, congratulations, don't sell him. He's gonna be useful for you all year. But if you're talking about a 12-team mixer and you're gonna drop a guy like Vince Velasquez to pick up Kendall Graveman, I would say please don't do that.
Okay, in a you know, 12 to 14 team mix league, are you dropping Tyler Glass now for Kendall Graveman?
Yeah, I might do that. I might want to, you know, keep him for that next start and see what this new delivery is.
Eli.
I mean, I would say that I still think the Glass now has a better ceiling. We're talking about a guy who has three pitches and velocity versus a guy who's throwing, you know, a fastball. I know it's three different fastballs, but it's all the same velocity band, you know. So I think at some point people are just going to sit, you know, 92 and put the ball in play.
Eli, your thoughts on Kendall Graveman?
Can we just move on to the next crappy, boring, no good player? No,
these are waiver wire guys. These are guys that are readily available.
I don't. I mean, you know, pretty much nailed it. I mean, he's fine. You know, he's a guy to have in your AL only team. You know, to give you a bunch of innings and be fine and not hurt you anywhere. But he's just not going to get the strikeouts and whatever. He's fine. He doesn't get me excited. I'm not rushing to get him in any format. Like, basically, if you're in the league deep enough for him to be owned, he's probably already owned, would be my guess, so whatever.
Okay. Eli, I'll start with you so you can just pass quickly. Scooter Gennett is off to a hot start. Any reason to buy into it?
No, not really. I feel like the best case scenario for him is something like 280 average, 15 homers, 60 RBIs, 65 runs, 10 steals. And those are all benchmarks that he's never once reached in any of those categories. So, and even those numbers are probably a little bit of a stretch. You know, I mean, if you were to reach those benchmarks, you know, it'd be a pretty decent middle infield option in NL only or whatever. But he's a lifetime 189 hitter against lefties. So please, whatever you do, do not put him in your lineup when he's facing a lefty.
You know, any interest in Jeanette?
A little bit. I don't know. It's a little crowded there. One thing I would say is that, yeah, I think that he might have a little bit more power than he's shown, and that, again, looking at his ground ball fly ball mix, he is putting in the air more than he ever has. So this could be a year for a career high in homers, maybe like 18. I don't think that would be impossible. And if he hits 18 homers, I think that'll probably mean that he's on the good side of his batting average. So it could be 275 with 18 homers and 8 to 10 stolen bases. That is useful in most leagues, if you think about it. More as like a utility guy, and maybe they'll move him around. I know that's what the Brewers are planning on doing. So depending on where he's eligible, that can be useful. And then you could basically put him on your bench in a head-to-head league, and then use him only against righties and when he's playing, and move him around your lineup. But when Jose Peraza, Zach Cozart, and Eugenio Suarez are healthy, there isn't really a great place for him to play. And then Duvall, Schebler, I believe a little bit in Schebler. Schebler hits the ball really hard. I know that he doesn't have the greatest play discipline, but he hits the ball really hard. I think he's going to be like a 80% Adam Duvall type. So that's not somebody you take out of your lineup to put Jeanette out there, you know. So I don't really see maybe post-Cozart trade. Because Cozart is probably one of the most tradable assets on this team.
And even with that, though, I've liked Jeanette in the past, and I do kind of believe in the power we're seeing, because he talked about earlier in spring training that he was going to make a concerted effort to put the ball out of the park. So I think this is partially an approach change on his part. But the Reds are, today called up
Jesse Winker.
And they called up Jesse Winker. So I think they're going to start calling up some of these guys that have been slow roasting in the minors, and they have Dilson Herrera down there. So I think he could be up pretty quickly as well. We see Philip Ervin or Tyler Goodell up. And I just think the more guys they start bringing up, if they're not worried about the service time issues, the less chances Jeanette's going to have to play. And so I think for right now, I think he's a DFS kind of play right now. You know, when you see he's in the lineup, he's going against a righty, especially
at home.
Go right ahead and throw him in there. But I worry that there's no long-term future for him in Cincinnati.
Yeah, Dilson Herrera, you're right. There's other things that they're going to be looking at, and,
Let's move on.
Just another guy. Jeez, come on.
Well, I'm going to throw two guys at you guys now to finish this out, and let's see if either of them are interesting to you. We have Antonio Senzatella. And Kyle Freeland both made the Rockies rotation as rookies. Any interest in either of these Rockies young guys?
No.
I feel like everyone loves Eno, so some people are going to tune into this podcast because we have Eno. But I feel like for the most part, the only people listening to this are going to be the family members and the parents of all these players.
Sorry. Your son is lovely. I'm sure he'll have all sorts of success in his career after baseball.
I'm guessing you feel the same way there, Eli.
Well, yeah, I don't really like either. But if I had to pick one, it'd be Senzatella. I mean, he's pitched a little bit better than Freeland through two starts. His numbers were a little bit better in the minors. I think Freeland's the bigger name, so people might gravitate towards him. But I just feel like Senzatella's proven himself to be a little bit better over the last few years. But, again, they pitch in cores. They don't get enough Ks or get enough ground outs to be effective in that environment. And plus, Senzatella pitched 35 innings last year, so obviously he won't pitch a lot this year. I mean, just, stream somebody else.
All right.
It's weird. Well, they're saying that Freeland has a 93-mile-an-hour four-seam and a 92-mile-an-hour sinker, but I was watching, and I saw a lot of 89. That must have been that cutter. He must have thrown that cutter a lot. I don't know, man.
You threw it about 21% of the time.
Yeah, okay. So I was
don't waste too much time thinking about Kyle Freeland, all right?
Well, it is interesting because he's basically another three fastball guy in that he throws the cutter, the four-seam, and the sinker 84% of the time. So if you like him, you think that changeup is good. And I don't know that, I guess the it's a straight change, but it doesn't have great velocity gap. So it's kind of a poopy change. So I don't really, that's a technical term.
Yeah. We're an explicit podcast, so feel free to just drop the language if you need to.
Oh, in that case, all these guys fucking suck, all right?
That's one thing I like about Senzatel, and I think he throws that it's a good fastball. 95 mile an hour fastball. So there I see some opportunity for him to be good. I just I don't know. I guess if I pick one of today, you know, the thing is I would only pick him up and pitch him on the road as much as that's a answer for guys. I just
what do you guys think Chris Sale's ERA would be in Coors Field?
Chris Sale's? Yes. I think he'd...
2-3-3.
Yeah, I was going to say
okay,
three.
So if Chris Sale's 3-3, these guys are going to be like 5. So don't pick them up.
Well, what do you think? I mean, there were some rumors that Quintana could end up in Colorado. I mean, you know, any thoughts on what would happen?
That would be so bad for him. Curves die there. It's not a good place for curveballs. And he has actually a worse change than people know, but the way he gets by, he has superb command of his fastball and curveball. So he can kind of get people rocking on those, and then he throws a kind of show-me changeup. But if he's got less movement on that curveball, I think that'll even affect his command of the pitch, even beyond just it having less movement. So,
nope. As a White Sox fan, I'm curious, you know, if you're the White Sox and you trade Quintana to the Rockies, what are you looking for?
I think actually position players.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like you got to get Tapia, McMahon.
Yeah, it's a weird thing. They ended up. I don't actually love Giolito, but I love Kopech, and I love Rodon. So you've got Kopech and Rodon as potential top guys, and then you have Giolito and Lopez as guys who could figure it out.
And Dane, you know, Dunning's
been fantastic his last two. Oh, he had 13 strikeouts in the second start.
Who's that?
Dane Dunning.
There you go. You always find a guy too. So, you know, I would focus on position players, and then you've got Moncada as a really interesting building block. I think Tim Anderson, maybe the ceiling has been lowered by the way that we've seen what he's done, but at the same time, the floor is pretty high.
Yeah. And from a real baseball standpoint, he plays good defense. So I mean, he helps out.
And the contract he just signed was a bargain. So.
Right, so you play that guy while he's cheap, and he's not going to be the worst shortstop in the league, and he's going to be super cheap. So that's a decent and maybe even re-sign Abreu. I mean, the thing that people forget about the White Sox is they have a little bit of money, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that they could.
And they're saving a lot of it this year too, so they can spend more later.
And Abreu, it doesn't have the upside that we thought he did either, because now everyone pitches him inside and he can't do much with it. But at the same time, he's still at least an average first baseman. And, you know, they're going to have the inside track on signing him. So, you know, add in a signing or two, Tim Anderson, Juan Moncada, you're still looking for position players.
Yep.
Well, and supposedly someone was telling me that they are – the favorite to sign Robert.
Yeah, I hope that happens.
So,
I don't know more than Kenny Williams, and I don't want to like affect somebody's livelihood and call for their jobs or anything. But I think Kenny Williams has had a detrimental effect on that team.
No argument.
I think he focuses too much on athleticism. And,
like Courtney Hawkins and there's so many other examples I can't think of them off the head.
Avisel Garcia, like, you know,
Diane Vicieto.
Well, he was kind of quirky.
None of
that. That was my
but
dude.
But hit ball hard.
Yeah, he did
for a little bit. But yeah, even Tim Anderson, you know, there's a lot of athleticism on those squads, but in terms of baseball skills, they're kind of lacking.
All right.
Jared Mitchell, that's another one. Ugh.
Oh yeah.
What happened to Gordon Beckett, man? I thought he was gonna be a stud.
he was real close to his peak because he was an old college guy.
He's hanging out with Brett Laurie.
They also got Zach Collins coming up at some point. That's at least an exciting bat to look forward to.
All right, well, that's going to wrap us up for this episode. Eno, why don't you remind people again where you reached on Twitter and plug your stuff?
Enosarris. And OCT.co is October's. That's the beer site. And I'm over at Fangraphs writing daily.
Can you spell Fangraphs for us?
Baseball.
Eli, why don't you tell people what you're working on and where you could be reached?
You can find me on Twitter at EliFWFB. And be sure to check out our Survivor podcast, especially after one of the craziest Survivor episodes of all time.
Yeah, we'll be recording that right after this. So that should be
interesting. My wife watches. I heard about that one.
Oh, yeah. It's going to be...
make sure she downloads.
I'll have to listen because I find that the show itself showed questionable morals by showing that.
Yeah. Well,
that's something we'll talk about.
I read something that he agreed to allow it to be shown.
All right. I mean, they do have some time. It's not live, so... Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's just like 3 or 4 months in advance. Right. You can reach me on Twitter at Justin Mason FWFB. Email me the show, friendsoffantasybenefits@gmail.com. You can read all my stuff over on Fangraphs, fantasy side, which is called Rotographs, or on friendsoffantasybenefits.com. I'm doing the Roto write-up 4 days a week over there, plus my weekly article on Fangraphs, so definitely go and check that out. And then please give us a rate and review. It really helps us out. We've been getting a lot of them, and if you do, that will get you entered in to potentially win some Friends of Fantasy Benefits gear that we'll be giving away all season long. So definitely do that for us. That will wrap us up for Eno, Eli, and myself. Thank you for listening. Have a fantastic baseball season.